Welcome to This Embodied Voice, the podcast where we talk about the voice, the body, and everything in between. My name is Suzanne Lees, and in this episode, I speak with tenor and trans activist Holden Madogamy. That's him singing an aria from Aces and Galatea by Handel, performed in early 2020 with the ensemble Le Mascare Galanti. We spoke about how he vocally navigated his transition and his experience taking testosterone, how he found his niche in the opera world, and what trans activism means for him at this moment in time. So, welcome to the podcast, Holden.
Thank you.
So, I've been starting the interviews with just these two simple questions. How are you feeling, and how is your body feeling today?
That's a great question. How am I feeling? To be honest, I'm not feeling particularly good. Been sort of dealing with some depression and just dealing with the pandemic and stress and whatever. Sorry about that. I think that's probably the wind in my door. So I'm not feeling particularly good, but I'm getting on and everything's totally fine and I'm safe and I have an apartment and everything's good. So, and how is my body feeling? My body is feeling tired. Not that it's done anything, but it's feeling tired for sure. But healthy and otherwise happy.
So I thought for the people listening who are unfamiliar with your story, you could just take us through your experiences as a singer, as a person.
Sure. Well, I guess I'll sort of start, I guess, like in high school is when I sort of got interested in singing. I grew up in like a very small town, like a very rural town in Michigan. And I got very lucky that we got a new choir teacher and she was very enthusiastic. And so she was like, you know, you can go to college for this. And I was like, what do I do with a degree in singing? And, but then I applied to colleges and I was doing, like state and all state choir stuff. And,
it's very big in the Midwest. Huh?
That's what I realized after I went to college. I was like, this is a very big thing in the Midwest.
So interesting.
And so then I got into University of Michigan and I went to the University of Michigan for vocal performance and I did my bachelor's there, as a mezzo soprano, basically sort of high mezzo soprano, coloratura mezzo soprano. And yeah, I was super happy and I love the school that I went to and, I really like mezzo soprano repertoire. And then I guess I'll just skip forward sort of after I graduated from my bachelor's, I sort of took like a year and a half or whatever to just sort of like figure out where I wanted to go. Cause I didn't necessarily want to stay in Ann Arbor forever. And then I moved to Berlin. Yeah. With the plan to do opera. Cause it was always kind of in the back of my head. I mean, I already sort of identified as like genderqueer and definitely identified as queer at the time. And so I was like, Berlin's great, Berlin's queer. And just moved. And so then like about a year of sort of like networking and figuring out Berlin, I got like massively depressed and dysphoric and just sort of stopped singing altogether. And sort of just came to a point where I was like, okay, well, I'm not singing. I'm not really doing anything. I came here to sing. So what am I doing? What is life? What is my existence? If I'm not singing, am I really a person? And then I decided to transition because I'd been thinking about hormones, been thinking about taking testosterone, definitely thinking about top surgery. And so since there wasn't really any information about taking testosterone and being a classical singer, I was just sort of like, okay, well, I guess I'll just do it because I'm not really singing anyway. Then sort of fast forward a couple of years, maybe I would say like a good 3 years, then I had like a functioning tenor voice. I'm now a working singer, I guess. I mean, apart from the pandemic, you know,
yeah,
but apart from that.
So to go back a little bit, would you be comfortable talking about your experience playing Cherubino when you're mezzo soprano in Marriage of Figaro?
Yeah, absolutely. Cherubino was like, I mean, as with most mezzo sopranos, was the first aria that I ever learned when I was like in high school, and was really one of the first things that grabbed my attention about opera. I was like, oh my God, there's like narrative. Because I don't know what I thought opera was up to that point, but narrative wasn't one of the things that I thought of. So when I finally got to do Cherubino, it was really like my first like big role or whatever. Is it? Yeah, it was my first full pants role on stage, like fully staged. And being able to embody that character fully in this production, and to embody this character that I love fully, was quite magical, to be honest. Because at the time I definitely sort of identified as genderqueer for myself and maybe a couple of friends, but and it had lots of feelings about my gender, but I don't know, I had never really related them to opera or like me playing as these male characters. And I also see Cherubino as very queer. The whole thing just feels very queer. But so I really related to this character in a lot of ways, and felt very much invested in how the character was portrayed, how I was portraying the character, how I felt being the character, which isn't necessarily always the case for all characters that we play in our careers. You know, I mean, sometimes we just sort of, we do the character, we do it well, we sort of get on with it, we relate to it as much as we can, you know, we sort of scrape into the character to figure out how to relate to it. But with Cherubino, I was just so into Cherubino. I was Cherubino. And I think it was really a large, it gave me sort of a large catalyst to sort of figuring out my gender and sort of figuring out how I felt about taking hormones or whatever. And I didn't end up taking hormones until whatever, at least a year and a half, 2 years later. But, I feel that very much was a catalyst. Oh, did you see that lightning? Did you get lightning too?
Oh, no. Oh my God, the sky is really weird. It's like
yellow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a storm brewing.
Ooh, this is very atmospheric. it's like the turbulence of identity or whatever. When you made a decision to start taking testosterone, can you talk about your vocal considerations and how your voice changed?
Yes. So when I was first considering taking testosterone, I already knew that, you know, testosterone has irreversible effects on the voice, basically. But there really, at the time, was nearly no research. There was one study that was done on amateur singers that I could find. Anyway, and basically it said they can't sing professionally, but also it's like, okay, well, they were amateur singers anyway, so they weren't singing professionally, so what about me? But I, you know, when I read that, I was like, okay, well, I guess I just can't do it. Like, I can either be trans and, or, you know, not be trans, but I can either take testosterone and sort of live the way that I want to live, or sing opera. So that was kind of like the sort of dichotomy that was in my mind, which then led to dysphoria and depression and not singing for a while. So then I emailed some former professors, and I sort of emailed friends, just trying to get different people's experiences, trying to find other trans singers. Very unsuccessfully. I found some trans women, which I was very thankful for, because at least there's some other trans people. But they were all like, okay, well, we have a totally different experience, so we also don't know. And so then I remember emailing one former professor, and she was really the only one that was like, you know, go for it. Maybe you'll be a tenor, and you know, if it doesn't work out, then that's okay. Basically, which was very much the permission that I needed, I think, to just sort of go for it. Because pretty much everybody else was saying, like, no, don't ruin your mezzo-soprano voice. You have a great mezzo-soprano voice, whatever. You'll ruin your career. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, I guess I'll be ruining my career then. So yeah, so then I just decided to... That's great.
Wait, that was so cool because I heard it. I don't know, one of them I heard first and one I heard later. So... Maybe I can sync it in the podcast.
That would be great.
I don't like blow their ears out. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man. This guy is creepy. It's brighter now. That's wonderful. Yeah. So then I went through the process of... there's a long process of being able to get hormones. You basically have to get... various experts to tell you that you're trans after you talk to them for a little bit. Luckily in Berlin, it's a little bit easier than in other places, I think, because there's sort of like a network of people that you can sort of ask, like, okay, what doctors give it easier than others or whatever. So, and I found a GP. Yeah. he doesn't like specialize in trans stuff, but he's just like very trans friendly, and so I went to him, and and I got testosterone. And at first he was like, yeah, because I told him that I was a singer and everything, he was like, well, you can start more slowly, you can take like half a shot, like half a dosage of a normal shot, or you could do a gel, but with gels it's a little bit complicated, because you can't touch anybody for several hours after you take a gel, and you have to do it every day. And I was like, I don't want to do anything every day. I don't want to do that. And so I opted for a shot, and I was going to take half a shot, but then I was like, whatever, I'll just take the full dose. And it worked out for me, not to say that, everyone should necessarily do that, but it worked out for me, and that's what I needed at the time. And I was also paying out of my own pocket, because I was on private health insurance at the time, and so it was less expensive as well. So then after a couple of months, I started to notice a difference in my voice. I don't know how many people would notice a difference if they weren't classically trained singers, but I noticed a difference in my voice, and definitely in my singing voice. My chest voice was stronger, and my head voice for a while was kind of the same, but then started to shift into this weird, like, not head voice but not falsetto, which was very interesting to experience, because I just never knew what falsetto felt like. And head voice as a mezzo-soprano is connected to your chest, and it's just completely different feeling entirely, because you have this sort of full body experience when you're in head voice as a mezzo-soprano. Even if you're singing up higher, it's just there's that connection, if you're doing it correctly anyway. And same thing with chest voice. It's like with chest voice, it was just a totally different experience, because it was like, as a mezzo-soprano, it's like, okay, there's a mix, or there's just like, it's just like chest. So then when my chest voice was getting stronger, there was like less of a mix and more of like, okay, well, this is like the core of my sound now. Like, this chest voice is now the sound, which was a very weird experience. And then also to have my head voice then be taken away from me was actually quite horrible, because I didn't have any problems with my mezzo-soprano voice, actually. That is not the reason I wanted to take testosterone. I liked my mezzo-soprano voice, and I would have preferred to probably keep it. But it was really quite jarring and quite... it's hard to describe it in another way besides dysphoric, in like a weird sort of upside down way, because that part of my gender was totally fine. So I was sort of in this weird no man's land of not being able to sing anything properly except maybe some like Italian art songs, like the Italian art songs. But then after a few more months, I just like couldn't even sing those. I just like had like an octave range to work with, and my voice would get really tired, even just from talking. I mean, you can still hear, like, I have air in my speaking voice, and I have air in my singing voice as well, and I'm still working to get it out, and that wasn't there before, and that's hormones. My voice still gets tired when I speak. My voice still gets tired when I sing, but it gets more tired when I speak than when I sing, but I think that's just, I think a lot of people are the same way. So then there was like several months where I was like, well, I can't really sing anything. So I was just doing like whatever, just like very reduced practice sessions, maybe doing bits of art songs, but kind of getting demotivated because I'm like, I can't really sing anything. So I was just sort of like doing runs or whatever, just to keep my voice alive. And then after about a year, I could sort of sing. I had more of a range anyway, and I could sing some simple tenor things, and it was, yeah, my voice sort of sounded like a tenor voice, but you can never really tell it at that point. Or now we know you can't really tell it at that point. Your voice can still change with more years on testosterone, but that's kind of where my voice ended up anyway. And I had also had my top surgery around the same time, about the 1 year mark. That was also really great for my singing, because I didn't have to bind my chest anymore, because it's really, really terrible. You can't sing correctly if you're binding your chest, because you can't use these muscles to breathe and support properly. You can't do it. So that was a big relief, but it also, I just was constantly relearning how to sing, basically. And then over the next couple of years after that, there were more changes, but it was more like, changes towards stability and changes to increase range gradually. There weren't any dramatic changes after one and a half years. But it was just, yeah, stabilizing at that point. And also through practice, of course.
Mm-hmm. And were you working with a teacher?
Yes, I was working with Stephanie Weiss. I was working with her whenever she was in Berlin, and also just like in contact with her. She's just a wonderful teacher, and has always just treated me with respect, and never really, like, I mean, we talked about trans things, obviously. She's just a superb pedagogue, and so she always treated me as a voice, you know, like not as anything else, which is very much my opinion when it comes to trans voices. There's definitely things that are specific to trans voices as far as like how trans voices transition. But basically they're voices, and you deal with the voice that's given to you when you're a teacher, and you work with that voice. And she always dealt with me in that way. And then occasionally she'd be like, whoa, that's really weird. I've never seen that before in a voice. And I'd be like, oh.
You said that you liked that she treated you just as a voice. And I'm wondering what the opposite of that would have been. How would you not have wanted to be treated?
That's a good question. I would say the opposite of that would be sort of fetishizing my voice as a trans voice that should be treated in a extra weird or special way. And yeah, trans voices are sometimes different or they act differently, especially when they're, you know, newly on hormones, especially. But basically, their voices and their, you know, we are bodies with voices. That's all it is. So, yeah. And I have had lessons before with some people who, not for longer than one lesson, but like with people who were like, oh, well, this must be because you're trans and your voice is doing this because it's trans. I'm like, no, it's just doing that because like, I'm, you know, I don't know what I'm doing as a tenor, like, you know, so it just feels so much more natural and completely avoids fetishizing trans voices. When you just treat it as a voice that is undergoing changes.
Something that I learned in preparation for this interview was the ongoing problem of the medicalization of trans bodies. Mm. And it does seem like teaching trans voices can also fall into this trap sometimes where there's a fetishization of the trans body and thus the trans voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Because if you're using sort of these very like clinical terms to talk about this body in front of you, it's hard to just describe, but it sort of in the direction of sort of the medicalization of trans bodies, sort of using these terms, whether it's like in singing lessons or wherever, just makes you feel like just a body, you know, like not a person anymore. You're just a body. That's also really unpleasant.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you and Stephanie had a productive working relationship because now you're a character tenor and it seems like that's the direction your voice is going in and also the way that you market yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. I would say it's, I don't know who put that into my head. I'm very, very thankful for whoever put that into my head, but someone basically was just like very practical, and I'm always won over by practicalities when people put in front of me. So I was just like, they were like, okay, well, you're the perfect physique for being a character tenor. You're short, you're sort of lithe or whatever. You are a good actor, you're expressive, whatever. And your voice projects, very importantly. So you should just be a character tenor because that's very useful. And to be a good character tenor is very much a worthwhile endeavor and something that is appreciated in Germany. So I was like, yeah, okay. apart from sort of how short I am, which is like, was sort of their main point, which is completely, completely understandable. I know that there's lots of short tenors, but I am extremely short even for a tenor. And so I was like, yeah, it totally makes sense to me. And I can still sing opera, which is the point. And I now really love the characters, that I do. They're very eccentric in one way or another. If you miss your entrance or something, it's gone. Like your whole role is gone. So you really have to kind of be on it to do it. You can't miss a beat. Otherwise you've completely messed up your entire role. And you know, one could say that the opera could go on without it. It definitely has before if a character tenor has missed their entrance, but, you know, they're part of the opera and they add a world to the opera. They add characters to the opera.
So you perform character tenor roles from the standard operatic repertoire, but you've also done some new works where you have a chance to portray trans characters. And I wanted to ask you about one of them in particular, Good Country, which is an opera premiered back in 2019, and it's based on the historical account of Charlie Parkhurst, who was a famous trans man during the California Gold Rush. Could you talk about that experience?
Yes. So the opera was called Good Country, and it was for the Cohen New Works Festival, and the composer was Keith Allegretti, and the librettist was Cecilia Raker. it was, I guess we don't know for sure, but it was one of the first times that a trans performer has collaborated to play a trans character for like a new work, basically. It was really a wonderful experience to have something written for my voice and also to have input into what was happening musically, what was happening dramaturgically, because, I mean, I am a trans person. This is a trans character. So, of course, I have opinions, but it was really wonderful to be able to express my opinions and to be able to sort of affect the dramaturgy in that way. And I feel very grateful to the team for that. And being able to, yeah, just being able to play another trans person who isn't myself in some way, or without sort of inserting my trans self into like a character role, for example, is not necessarily what I consciously do, but, you know, like when I'm trying to get into a character, I am trans and I am playing this character. And so the character is often inherently quite queer in some way and sort of has an interesting gender in some way. But this was really the first time where I was like, okay, this character is trans. Like, I don't need to do any like extra work or to sort of mold myself into this character. It's like, this character isn't me. It's a different trans person, but I am also trans. It's hard to describe how having that different relationship to that character makes such a big difference. It's also like how I imagine playing an explicitly queer person would feel like, or I don't know, being a person of color and explicitly playing a person of color. Yeah, it's quite different than molding yourself into whatever's on the other end.
Do you feel better supported as a trans person in Germany rather than the US?
Yes. Yes, basically. Because the sort of the medical care that I've received here is just, it's already in the system, you know? Like, it's still difficult and you still need to have lots of appointments and you need to talk to lots of people about your experiences being a trans person and do all of these surveys or whatever, with hundreds of questions about whatever is in your psyche. And that's, there's all of that, but, you know, there's a system for it. And I know, I always knew it's like, okay, if I do all of these things, I will get testosterone. I will get some sort of medical care. Also, the good thing sort of socially about being in Germany is that, which, you know, sometimes is a sort of double-edged sword, but is that people don't really ask questions. You know, like, people don't really pry into your personal life in general in Germany. And so sometimes people don't realize I'm trans because they, I mean, they don't really ask any sort of personal questions or anything. And so they don't know that, or they do know that and they never bring it up. So I don't even really know if they know. So, but it pretty much never has been a problem here. The other side of that is that it is sometimes hard to find community or I find it hard to talk about being trans without making other people uncomfortable because they see it as something very personal that maybe I shouldn't be talking about, which does make me uncomfortable because I want to talk about it and I feel like it's important to talk about and it is part of my identity. And if they don't want me to talk about that, they are actively sort of repressing that part of my identity. So in that way, the US is a lot easier to talk about these things socially, even though the system is a mess. So, yeah, but I'm happy here and I'm really glad that I could do my transition here.
it seems in general that you made a really concerted effort to have a very public coming out as trans and also very public transition. And I was wondering why you chose to do that, because you definitely don't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. That was very much a conscious choice. I prefer if people know that I'm trans, for one thing. Mm. So that helps me in a direct way. But more so, I have the ability to, express myself articulately about my feelings and the physical things that are happening to me. I have the ability to articulate those things. I have the safety to articulate those things. I'm in a safe community. I'm in Berlin, but my family back in the States supports me, and my friends support me, and that gives me a lot of privilege, and sort of with those powers combined, so to speak, I kind of feel like I need to do this for other people, especially because when I first started taking testosterone, there was really nobody. Like, I couldn't find anybody. Now there's lots of people. I mean, comparatively lots of people. And I think that's wonderful. And I wanted to give that to other people, to be at least one person, at least like one person that someone could go to YouTube and sift through the videos and be like, oh, there's one trans person who took testosterone and is a classical singer. Even if there weren't any more, then that will give one person hope to be able to sing classically and take testosterone. And they wouldn't have to have this whole, however much time I spent being depressed, thinking that I couldn't do both of those things. That saves them at least a little bit of time and a little bit of emotional energy by me doing that. And I already know it's helped people. I get emails every so often from people who are just like, wow, like, I found your YouTube channel and I'm really thankful. And now I feel like I can take testosterone, and that's exactly what I wanted.
And when you hear from trans babies, as you call them, do you see in like several of their cases that there's one thing that's missing? Is it like, institutional support or familiar support, or is it sort of the thing where they haven't gotten the permission themselves to do it?
That's an interesting question. Often what I see is partially the institutional support that you mentioned. Either they're looking at colleges or they're already in college or in a conservatory or like whatever. And they want to take hormones and they don't have the support, everybody is telling them that they shouldn't do it, or nobody has the answers for them, or nobody is willing to help them if they do decide to take hormones. And so I see that quite a lot. And I also see basically that they need someone to tell them that it's okay, that it will be okay. Mm-hmm. I would say pretty much everybody who's emailed me is just, apart from the people who are just like, thank you, now I can take testosterone. apart from them, everybody else who has questions basically is just looking for affirmation that their decision is valid and that the direction that they want to take by taking hormones is valid and that it will be okay. And I always categorically tell them it will be okay. Any decisions that you take regarding this will be okay. There will be lots of variables which I can't predict and that they can't predict, but that it will be okay. And probably better just for taking a decision. Whatever that decision is, not to say that taking hormones is always the right decision at that time, but just sort of getting the affirmation that they need and then taking the decision and then feeling good about that decision, it will be okay.
Is it hard to like balance the activism side of your life, like responding to emails from trans babies or doing interviews like this one, or where you necessarily end up having to talk about some like really hard times? Is it hard to balance that with like the rest of your life, was just, you know, trying to lead a full contented life, like we're all trying to lead?
Sometimes, I would say when I was actively sort of doing a lot of videos and I had my Patreon and things like that, I found it difficult to balance, unfortunately. And I always feel like I want to do more, or that I should do more. And so I kind of struggle with that personally, just knowing that I want to do more activism, and that it's not always really clear what that even means. You know, like, what does doing activism look like? Sometimes it looks like doing an interview. Sometimes it looks like answering someone's question on Facebook, you know, or sometimes it's just answering an email from a trans baby. Or sometimes it's just sticking up for yourself. Sometimes it's as simple as that. And as my partner likes to say, sometimes just existing as a trans person is activism, you know. Existing in a world that people don't necessarily want you to exist in is its own sort of activism. Existing in an industry that isn't familiar with you and that you need to sort of constantly have discussions about is it in itself activism. And something that Lucia Lucas and I talk about sometimes is sort of how just doing your job well as an opera singer and being trans is, you know, sometimes most of what we should be doing, or most of what we can do, just doing the job, which I try to remind myself when I'm sort of like, oh, I need to do more activism or whatever. I'm like, no, I just need to do my job really well and be trans.
So something I know I've been thinking a lot about, and I think a lot of people have been because of the pandemic, is like what makes me an artist, and also kind of when am I an artist? Is it like when I'm making money making art? Is it when I'm spending a lot of time making art? And I'm asking this because you've recently been working as a programmer. And I was wondering how you feel about that work, especially identity-wise, because it seems like you had such a strong tie between your singer identity and your person identity. And I'm wondering how this relatively new kind of phase of work as a programmer has affected that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I mean, not being able to do singing work definitely does sort of gives me complicated feelings about my identity as a human being, as a person. Like, if I'm not singing, am I myself? Am I a person? If I'm not making art, am I a singer or a person? But programming has been really quite wonderful for me, I think, because as a kid, I wanted to be a video game designer. Like, ever since I was like 7 or something, I was like, I'm going to be a video game designer. My parents were totally cool with that. you know, they were like, we don't really know what video games are. We bought him a Super Nintendo and now he's obsessed. That's great. Like, do what you want. And you know, that's what I said pretty much up until like junior year of high school. I was like, I'm going to be a video game designer. And then I sort of like realized, I'm like, okay, I'm better at singing. I don't really know how how building a career as a singer really works, but I'm clearly like better at this and want to do this. But that's sort of always been something that I'm interested in. Technology and programming, so actually it's been really great to sort of exercise this part of my personality and this part of my sort of childhood desire, I guess. And putting that into practice, and being in a totally different environment with totally different people. It's really been an interesting experience. It is still complicated because I very much am a singer and that's part of my identity. And so sometimes I feel like, sorry, my brain just mixed up a whole bunch of metaphors. I was like, I don't know what metaphor I was looking for. My brain was like a koala in a horse pen or something like that. I was like, brain, what are you doing? That good old metaphor.
Sounds Australian, surely.
But yeah, so sometimes I feel like I stick out and I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. You know, it's good to interact with different people. It's good to express different parts of your personality in different places. But I do look forward to singing again someday.
Mm-hmm. I had one kind of like goofy question.
Yeah, please.
I wanted to ask you about your tattoos, if that's okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So you have this one that's like more recent. And if anyone's curious, you can find it on Holden's Instagram. But would you be willing to talk about the more recent one? Well, and the older one, but start with the more recent one.
By more recent one, do you mean the potato baby?
Yes, I was scared to call that because I had here written potato child. And I was like, oh no, Suzanne, what if you just wrote that down? You're going to say that and offend him. So.
No, I call it potato baby for myself. Wait, did you read potato child anywhere? Or that just came to your head?
I probably read potato baby and wrote down potato child.
That's great. Yeah, my potato baby is actually a flash tattoo from an artist I really love and a friend of mine. And I don't know why, but I just like, I saw it on their Instagram and I just absolutely fell in love. I'm like, I have to have the potato baby on my skin. And I don't really know why, but I need it. And I love that for tattoos. When you just like sort of fall in love with an artist and you're just like, it speaks to my soul, whatever that means. Yeah, I don't know. I can't be very articulate about the potato baby because it just gives me lots of feelings and it. but
what kind of feelings?
Well, it gives me some like gender feelings, like, oh man, the potato baby is just sort of this like beautiful little blob with little like feetsies with these beautiful eyelashes and these lips and like, I don't know, it's just like the gender is just like, mwah, it's so good. And it's just like, so I don't know, it speaks to my soul. Something about that gender is just like me. I don't know, it's just weird and cute, like me. And then I think the other one is probably the merman you're talking about, right?
I have two here. One potato child, one tattoo of a bear with the human.
Oh, yeah. Mask. Yeah. So those are both the same artist. They're in Berlin, Alkfein. Yeah, the custom one with the bear with a human mask, I really like because it just kind of feels like, I don't know. It also just kind of feels like a very trans experience. It's like you're something and then you're sort of like putting on this human mask or whatever, but you're actually like something else, whatever that is. Mm. Not to like other trans people, but you know, that's my experience. It's just like being this other thing behind this human mask and then sort of expressing whatever's behind that.
Yeah. And then is there a third one, a merman one?
Yeah. Actually, I have four tattoos. I have a merman, which I just always wanted a merman. I don't have another explanation for that. But it's a custom tattoo. And I can also write you the artist for the show notes. But I don't know. I wanted a merman. I think there's some sort of trans thing with people, yes, too.
I wanted to talk about this. Apparently, there's like interpretations that like the Little Mermaid is like the original story, the Hans Christian Andersen one, is sort of a trans like parable of sorts.
Oh, really? Oh, how exciting!
Yeah, I mean, don't quote me on this.
My brain's gonna do it anyway, whether it exists or not. I believe you though.
it's sort of like the idea of like the body, like the body and the voice as being these like separate entities, but they're also changeable, but they're also sort of like fixed and they have all these conditions on them. And the idea that you can only like be acceptable in one form in one world and then acceptable in another world in a different form, like bridging those worlds through a body change.
Yeah.
And then also the, you know, like the Disney version of Little Mermaid. Ursula is inspired by Divine, like one of the very early drag queens.
Really? That's wonderful. Yes. And believable.
Do some Googling. It's a really fun internet black hole to
like. Oh, yes. I'm going to write that down immediately. Oh, because I've always felt Ursula had a very interesting gender, and Ursula has always felt super queer to me as well. Yes. And I didn't really know why. I was like, Ursula's queer and she's mine, but I don't know why.
You said the merman just always sort of felt like a very trans or queer thing to you.
Yeah, it's definitely not the reason I got it. I definitely was just like, I want a merman, I don't know why. And then almost immediately, like the day after I got it, one of my trans friends was like, oh, typical trans person with a merman tattoo. I'm like, what?
I thought I was just so unique. Yeah,
exactly. I thought only I had lots of feelings about mer people.
Sorry, if you're sick of tattoo questions, let me know.
Oh, I love talking about tattoos.
What's the fourth tattoo?
Yeah, I have one more tattoo, which your viewers would not be able to see, but you'll be able to see. It's an elk. And it was my first tattoo, which is massive for first tattoo. It was just like at a time in my life where I was like, you know, I don't know, a lot was changing for me and I had always wanted to tattoo, but it was like that sort of typical thing of like, I don't know what to get. I don't know what to commit to put on my body for the rest of my life sort of thing. Which completely breaks after you get your first tattoo. I was like, what do I put on my body forever? And then I just like made this doodle in my journal at the time. It was just like this ugly little doodle. And then I was like really obsessed with this one tattoo artist. I'm like, can you make this beautiful and put it on my body? And he did. And it's wonderful. And I love it.
gorgeous.
Yeah. I think originally it didn't like, I didn't really conceptualize it as having like a specific meaning or whatever, but, sort of the image of an elk is sort of like tied to my father. I don't know if we talked about this, but my father passed away when I was like 18. So I think that is sort of part of it in a not really well articulated meaning. It's just sort of very.
Yeah, I think nor does it have to have meaning. It can like acquire meaning or the meaning can kind of like wane and wax in a way.
Absolutely. That's definitely how I feel about a lot of my tattoos. There's only one that really has a specific meaning. That's the bear with the mask. Everything else is just like, that's nice. That gives me feelings.
Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking me and thank you for thoughtful questions and a nice Unterhaltung.
Das freut mich sehr. Alrighty. Have a great evening. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
And if you're curious to see pictures of some of the tattoos we talked about with Holden, you can find them on his Instagram, which is @holden.mad, M-A-D. And if you want to follow his career, you should check out his website, holdenmonogamy.com. He also has a great blog, and he links to his YouTube channel as well, all of which I highly recommend checking out. And thank you so much for listening to the second episode of This Embodied Voice. In case you're new here, this is a podcast where we talk about the voice, the body, and pretty much everything in between. And if you enjoyed the episode, it really helps to rate, review, subscribe, and tell your friends. You can also reach me, Suzanne, on Instagram @ThisEmbodiedVoice. Until next time, take care of your body, take care of your voice, and be well.